And here is the Chatuma Sutta, Majjhima 67. And as you can see from here, it has a number of parallel versions. We're reading from, of course, Majjhima Nikaya number 67. Has a Chinese version at Ekotara Agama 45.2. The Ekotara Agama being a text of the... And Tafi, hang on. Give everyone else a go. Being a text of the... at least that is an actual school of Buddhism, so that's doing pretty well. A text of the... Keep going.
Mahasangika.
Okay.
What about that T?
Is that, I know that because people get it mixed up with Mahayana.
That's right, they do, yeah. Except for Mahayana's people who don't. But and then another one, T137. So this is an independent sutta. Muktaka sutta.
That written by someone who knows. Is that independent?
Not so much part of what means. It just means that it's not included in a collection.
It's translated here and there.
Translated in bits and pieces, yeah. So we don't really know where that comes from. So a bit unusual in that there's no direct corresponding versions from Sarvastivadin school, unless this one perhaps is Sarvastivadin, maybe. But as we'll see, that there are some bits and pieces that are parallel to various other things.
Partial.
Yeah, so what does partial parallel mean?
Bits of it are there.
Bits of it are there? That depends on how we had some considerable discussion when we designed this sort of central website and a certain degree of controversy, I might add. And we decided after trying to think of doing it in more kind of sophisticated ways, we decided to just end up with this twofold system where if you put something as a parallel, what that says is what that means is that we think that this is probably an alternative version of the same sutta, whatever same sutta means. Right? If we have partial parallel version, means this may or may not be another version of the same sutta, but if you're researching this sutta, you'll probably want to have a look at this one. That's what that means. Okay, so that's that. Okay. Oh, yeah, the cord is going.
Yes, the cord is going.
Okay. That's good. I'm going to say it again. Chatuma Sutta. So, where's Chatuma?
It has a Myro Balam Grove.
Do you want the Pali proper name thing?
No, it's not in here.
What is that?
Does anybody know?
It's on vipassana.info.
Well, it must be something Sakyan because there's Sakyan businessmen there.
Sakyan businessmen are there, excellent. That's very good. So that means it's up in the north somewhere. Chatuma, a Sakyan village containing a moat hall. Have we got on there?
There it was, the Amalakawana.
That's the Marabalan, isn't it? Amalaka? Amalakawana? Where the Buddha once stayed and preached the Chatuma Sutta. Okay, Sakyan village containing a moat hall. So it means they probably don't know exactly where it was. Okay. So, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Chatuma in a Marabalan grove. The Marabalan, of course, the famous Somor. The famous Somor. Somor. It's in Thailand. It's a Marabalan. Amalaka. Amalaki in this village. What sort of a tree is it? I'm not sure. I think it's a big tree with some moles hanging on. Some more tree than you know. Anyway, it's a medicinal fruit, all right? Regarded as having many virtues in Ayurvedic medicine, and still in Tibetan medicine, they still use it a lot. Now, on that occasion, 500 bhikkhus headed by the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahamoggallana had come to Chattama to see the Blessed One. So, of course, we all know who Venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana are, the two chief disciples, Sariputta being foremost in wisdom, and Mahamoggallana being foremost in
psychic
powers, flying through the air and all that kind of cool stuff. While the visiting bhikkhus were exchanging greetings with the resident bhikkhus and were preparing resting places and putting away their bowls and outer robes, they were very loud and noisy. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda thus, "Ananda, who are these loud and noisy people? One would think they were fishermen hawking fish." So, this is the Buddha's attitude towards fishermen. Well, obviously, yeah, he didn't have such a high opinion of the poor old fishermen. Kevata Matavilope Kevata Manye. One would imagine that there were fishermen hauling in the fish. This Uccha Sada, as in Uccha Sayana Mahasayana, we know from the precept chanting, the high and we translate it high and luxurious, but high, literally high and big. Uccha, high noise, and a maha sada, a loud noise, big noise. Okay. Now, I don't know if it occurs to any of you, but it does occur to me that this particular passage might even have some practical application in some way. do you think so, or is that just my imagination playing tricks with me? What's the practical application, Eva?
Well, I think it's a game that the Buddha plays with his men sometimes. And they all know the game. That's why they don't get upset when he tells them to get their stuff and go. They just quietly get their stuff and go.
Uh-huh.
Because this is the bit of a sort of back and forth.
A bit of a back and forth, okay. Is there any significance to the fact that there's no... And, you know, if I wanted to make a big deal out of this, you could. There's no parallel passages anywhere where the Buddha tells the bhikkhunis to get lost.
Just
because they're so quiet.
Anyway.
Ah, because they don't need much. Maybe it's because they don't need much teaching. They're so good, they just get on with it.
Don't men like being disciplined?
Yeah?
Yeah. Women don't. Good teaching skills.
Really, I'll bear that in mind. Okay. A bit of a hint there. Okay. Okay, so the Buddha praised quiet. "Venerable Sir," Ananda replied, "there are 500 bhikkhus headed by Sariputra Moggallana who have come to Chattama to see the Blessed One." Notice how that when he refers to Sariputra Moggallana, it's always in a compound. Sariputra Moggallana Bhammukha. So headed or led by, and then puts them together as if they're almost the same person, yeah? Or it's compounded.
Is that a common habit?
Do you want
to? For the two of them?
Not so common, no.
Because because this is the first time I've seen it.
Yeah, no, for the two of these it is, yeah, but it's not so common elsewhere. But obviously it just it became such a common idiom that they're always together that it was used that way. Yeah. To come to Jhadrama to see the Blessed One, and while the visiting bhikkhus were exchanging greetings with the resident bhikkhus, then they made a loud noise. And then Ananda tells those bhikkhus to, in my name, that the teacher calls the Venerable Ones. Okay? So, Tena Hananda, Mama Vachanena, of me, literally, my Vachanena, speech, by my speech. I love those speakers, tell the speakers.
What's the Amantesi? It's normally Amantesi, isn't it?
Sorry?
Amantesi, normally.
It's not normally anything, it depends on what the case
what
is.
What case is that?
Amanteti is he addresses, and Amantehi is the second person. Amantehi, second person
imperative.
Is that right?
Ooh.
Second person imperative. Yeah. We haven't done imperatives yet. Okay, then they came to the Buddha and the Buddha admonished them, "Why are you so loud and noisy when you would think you were fishermen hawking fish?" And they responded that they've come, and when they were greeting the resident bhikkhus, preparing resting places, putting away our bowls and outer robes, that we were very loud and noisy. So the monks were very honest and straightforward in that, and of course this being quite a common occurrence in monasteries, you know, visiting groups of monks coming in, everyone's so good to keep restraint. And the Buddha's words, not particularly
cordial,
he's not trying to butter him up, all right? He just tells it to him straight. Okay, I think the Buddha was an Aussie. He just gave it to him. Go bhikkhus, gacchata bhikkhave, get lost bhikkhus. I dismiss you. You should not live near me. Panamemi, navo mama santike watabba. You should not live around me. Santike. Yes, Venerable Sir, they replied. They rose from the seats, after paying homage to him, keeping to their right, they put the things in the resting place, taking their bowls and outer robes. They departed. Bakamingsu. It's an aorist, plural. They departed. Now, Tena Kopana Samayena. On that occasion, the Sakyans of Chatuma had met together in their assembly hall for some business or other. Santhagare. Okay, is the Santhagara, is the assembly hall. So this would be basically like the town hall, yeah? Except in those days the town hall would be probably used more than they are these days, yeah? And so it would be where people would get together to discuss the village business and so on and so forth. Kenachi Deva Karaniena, okay? So for some business or other, okay? Kenachi is like some kind of business. The D here is just a sandhi consonant. Some people have tried to argue that it's supposed to be kenachi deva karaniena, so for a certain religious duty, but it's not really that. It's just a sandhi. Okay. Seeing the bhikkhus coming in the distance, they went to them and said, "Where are you going, Venerable Sirs? Friends, the Sangha of bhikkhus has been dismissed by the Blessed One." Okay. "Then let the Venerable Ones be seated a while." Muhuttang nisidata. For just a minute, if you sit down for a minute. Muhuttang. And then perhaps we shall be able to restore his confidence. Okay? So, pasadetu, the faith of the Buddha. So the Buddha is obviously lacking in the faith according to them. So this being an interesting, one of the interesting things about the sutta is the fact that the Buddha gets persuaded. Now then the Sakyans of Chautama went to the Blessed One after paying homage to him. They sat down at one side and they said, "Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One delight in the Sangha of Bhikkhus." Okay. Abhinandatu bhante bhagava bhikkhu sangham. Abhivadatu. Let the Blessed One help delight the Sangha of Bhikkhus and help them just as he did in the past. Okay, abhivadatu. Okay. Venerable Sir, there are new bhikkhus here, just gone forth, recently come to this Dhamma and Vinaya. So notice how whenever the Buddhism is referred to, it's not referred to as Buddhism, it's referred to as Dhamma Vinaya. Yeah? If they get no opportunity to see the Blessed One, there may take place in them some change or alteration. Okay? And so these words, change and alteration, these are used in quite an idiomatic way in Pali, and viparinamo, and they basically what it means here is that they're probably disrobed. So it's always used in a sense of you know, quite a seriously bad sense. Yeah, when it says to change or an alteration, like when we use the word alteration, it's quite neutral. Yeah, we're going to alter the house. Well, that means maybe improving it, and so it's going to be better. But these words specifically, they really mean a decline or a degeneration. They're going to fall apart. Okay, something bad's going to happen to them, and they're pretty much always used that way. Venerable Sir, just as when a young calf does not see its mother, there may take place in it some change or alteration. Okay. 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 Just as when some young seedlings get no water, there may take place in them some change or alteration. So the seedlings is bijana, tarunana. So some young seeds, then they need the water. And then similarly, this is a second simile further down, if a young calf does not see its mother, there may take place some change or alteration, which is...
What's
calf? Calf, just looking for
it.
Bijana.
Bijana is the seedling. What's calf?
Vachasa.
Vachasa.
Vacha.
And what's cow? Or mother? Oh no, we don't have
it. It has matarang here. Cow is go or gava.
Yeah.
Go. It's usually that's the nominative form is go. This cow. But there's actually, as you could well imagine, in Pali, there's actually quite a lot of different words for cow. There's a whole different stack of them, actually.
Vachasa is one of them.
Vachasa is one of them, yes. This is the calf. Yeah. Vachasa and Denu and Usabha and Gorampati and so on and so forth.
It's just amazing to see the movement in the languages sometimes.
Yeah.
Mataran, that's Mata.
Yeah.
Mother.
Yeah.
In Polish, cow is
krowa. Krowa.
In Polish, that's right.
Yeah, that's well. Okay. There you go. Thanks.
These monks
that are being raised. How many are there? Is it
500?
And they're all staying with
Sariputra Moggallana.
And more Moggallana?
Yeah.
And so if they're arahants, they get all their teaching and inspiration from them. So why do they, why would they get more from seeing the Buddha if, you know,
That's a good question.
It's alright, it comes in a bit and you'll find out why.
Mm-hmm. We'll find out why.
So it's like,
yeah, you don't always find that, well, one of the things you find about monastic life is that it's not always the good monks who hang around with the good teachers. Yeah? And that sometimes, for various reasons, yeah, sometimes. You know, the teachers are very happy to take on problematic monks and just have them around so they can help them. Other times, maybe the student, maybe if there's a good teacher, they get lots of good food and stuff like that, and so it's quite fun to hang around with them because you get to meet interesting people and stuff. So, you know, it's not at all uncommon that if you have some famous teachers, that you'll have a group of monks are hanging around them who maybe not themselves necessarily all that well practiced. This is not at all. In fact, it's probably quite normal.
So he's telling them to go see the Buddha so that the Buddha straightens them out?
No, he's not telling them to go to the Buddha.
Oh,
but
the Buddha
heard them.
Mm.
Told them to come.
Mm.
Yeah?
Sorry, Buddha and his mate are really quite happy with these guys.
Oh, so do I fix them?
Let's just go on with the sutta, shall we?
500 in Pali means a lot of people.
Okay.
Yeah, 500 means heaps, yeah.
Mm.
Doesn't mean 500 exactly.
Now, okay, so trying to keep track of this. Seems to be some problems with the text here. But anyway, Asakimsu, seems to have missed out a section in the Pali. But anyway, then the Brahma Sahampati knew with his mind the thought in the Blessed One's mind just as quickly. Vanished from just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, he vanished in the Brahma world and then reappeared before the Blessed One. As he arranged his upper robe on one shoulder, extended his hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One, he said, "Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One delight in the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Venerable One, the Blessed One welcome the Sangha of Bhikkhus now as he used to help it in the past," and so on and so forth. And the Sakyans of Gautama and the Brahma Sahampati were able to restore the Blessed One's confidence with the similes of the seedlings and the young calf. Okay?
What does the Chinese say?
Oh, I'll come to that in just a moment, yeah. Asakinsu, okay, Tatu Meyaka, Tisakya, the Sakyans of Gautama, and Brahma Sahampati, they were able to pasadetum. To please him, to cause him to have faith, to rouse faith in the Blessed One. With the simile, the upama of the seed, and the simile of the... It doesn't say vacha here. It says taruna, of the youngling, perhaps. Yeah, it just says youngling, it says taruna. Fledgling of the youth. And notice the aorist with, you'll be delighted to know. The augment. Oh, beautiful. Look at that. Look at that. He's a delight in the augment. So this is... It's not worth it just for that one augment. So this A is doesn't have a negative sense here, okay, as is clear from the context, but it means... it's just part of the aorist tense, so it means in past tense they were able, were capable, as Hakimsu. Mm-hmm. Then Venerable Mahamoggallana addressed the bhikkhus thus: "Get up, friends, take your bowls and outer robes. The Blessed One's confidence has been restored by the Sakyans of Gautama and the Brahma Sahampati with the similes of the seedlings and the young calf." "Yes, friends," they replied, and getting up from their seats, taking the balls and outer robes, went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One asked Venerable Sariputta, "What do you think? What did you think?" Okay, so before we go on there, I might just check in with the Chinese parallels, and before we go on with it, just the rest of that bit there. So
than another is.
Before the question started, do you think I find there's a remark there that Dham sees the Gayadi is the Brahma who convinced the Buddha to give his teaching in the first place?
Yeah, yeah.
So, seems like a very important figure.
Right.
What is it doing here?
Yes, well, that's a good point. Yeah, see, it seemed a bit. Yeah, yeah, and you can imagine that the Sakyans of Chantuma sort of going on their side and that thing, but for Brahma to actually neglect his duties in being lord of the world and coming down looking for that, you're quite right. It's a bit, they must have been, I don't know.
Maybe they were mates in a previous life.
Yeah, maybe they were friends in the previous life. Yeah. But obviously that whole episode of the Brahma being included just parallels the previous one, yeah? So of course it's very easy to just take out the Sakyans of Chatama and put in Brahma Sahampati and then double the whole thing. Not difficult to do, yeah? But we'll see if the Chinese has anything to say on that. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so... Sahampati, yeah.
Like the top of the
Brahmas,
like, you know, the other religions, they have their god, is that
the
top being there? Like, the one who thinks that he's eternal, but he's not
really?
He's one of those kind of
Brahmas, yeah.
So, like, the one that...
Except this one's now a stream emperor, so he's okay.
He's a stream... Oh, so he's a...
He's cool.
Okay, he's cool. Okay.
He's just one of the Brahmas, right?
Yeah, he's one of the Brahmas, yeah. But Sahampati Pati means the lord, or commander...
Yeah.
And Sahang, I'm not entirely sure what it is, but it's probably from Sahasa. It's probably an abbreviation of Sahasa, meaning thousands. So he's probably like the lord of a thousand worlds, a thousand world systems, something like that.
And in another sutta, we had a monk who was looking for the end of the universe, like that, and then there was a Brahma that said,
yep.
I know everything.
Another sutta which also featured fishermen, incidentally, but go on.
So that was not Brahma, that was.
That was another Brahma, yeah.
Okay, just to get the context.
Yeah, yeah, no, this is another. This is a good Brahma. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Okay, according to the two Chinese versions, he did not even call the monks into his presence, but simply told Ananda to send them away. So there you go. The three versions agree that a group of Sakyans and the god Brahma intervened on behalf of the monks. According to the Chantama Sutta, the Sakyans and Brahma each delivered the same two similes describing a seed in need of water and a calf longing for its mother to illustrate the need these newly ordained monks had of the Buddha's presence. The same two similes recur in the Ekotara Agama version, which, however, attributes only one simile to each party, the Sakyans being the authors of the seed, simile of the seed in need of water, while Brahma was responsible for the simile of the calf longing for its mother. Okay? This presentation makes sense, since if the Sakyans had already delivered both similes, there would seem to be little reason for Brahma to intervene and just repeat what had already been said. So, the independent sutta, T137, has only the Sakyans delivering a simile which was concerned with water flowing quickly down a ravine. Not sure, but it did say that Brahma was intervening there. So anyway, certainly does make sense, at least if they're giving different similes, then that might give a bit more reason for Brahma to want to neglect his celestial pleasures for 5 minutes. Okay. But of course, things get a little bit more complicated than that. Another Pali discourse found in Sanghita Nikaya, however, reports Brahma delivering the same two similes on another occasion when the Buddha had dismissed a group of monks. Okay? So Brahma was reported as giving both of them. In the Sanghita Nikaya discourse, the two similes had already occurred to the Buddha on his own while being in solitude and reflecting before Brahma came and repeated them. Hence, in this case, similar to the Chatama Sutta, Brahma's function is only to repeat the two similes. The Chinese... Okay, and that's, again, not particularly unusual. There's cases like when the Buddha's reflecting and he sort of thinks about something and he says, oh, this four Satipatthanas are the Ekayana Magga, the whatever you want to translate it, the one and only, the way leading to convergence or whatever you want to translate it as. And then Brahma comes down and repeats and reinforces. So that's one of the roles that he has, is to repeat and reinforce what's already been said. Hence, in this case, the Chinese parallel to this Samyutta Nikaya discourse, however, does not report either the Buddha or Brahma coming out with any of these two similes. So, a bit uncertain there. The relationship in time between this discourse and the Chaitanya Sutra is not clear. So that one could be tempted to think that if these two similes did indeed occur to the Buddha while being in seclusion, he might have remembered them from the time when he first came across them in relation to the events depicted in the Chaitanya Sutta. According to the explanation given in the Milinda Panha, however, okay, Milinda Panha being Questions of King Milinda, yeah. So this is the record of a debate between King Milinda, the Greek king, Menander, and a monk called Nagasena. And that occurred maybe 400 years after the Buddha, 400 or 500 years after the Buddha's Parinibbana. And there's several versions of that particular thing. The most well-known one is the Pali version, but there's also one or two Chinese versions and bits and pieces here and there. Much of it has, of course, been expanded. It's not sure how much of it was actually the dialogue of Milinda and Nagasena. Anyway, it's considered as quite important within the Pali school. And one of the things that the Milinda Panha always does is it takes up problematic questions and so on from the Buddhist scriptures, and then Milinda asks Nagasena about it, and so the king says, well, what about this, you know, this is this kind of problem in the text, and then Nagasena gives some explanation for it. So this was one problem here, is if the Buddha knew everything already, how come the Buddha had to be persuaded, right? So this is obviously quite an interesting kind of psychological issue. Can you persuade an all-enlightened Buddha to do something which he thinks is a bad idea? According to...
And are we talking about omniscience?
Mood. Do Buddhas have moods? I don't know.
But didn't you say Ananda also persuade the Buddha to allow women into...
Well, that was another issue, yes.
There are others.
Yeah, that was another one. And there was... also other cases like...
And Sahamati telling him that there are people of little dust in their eyes.
Exactly, yeah. Brahma, somebody going to teach in the first place, yeah.
And what about refusing to have people meet for a while?
Yeah, we did have that.
No, Ananda. Sorry, Ananda.
Of course you would know that.
Well, okay. Yeah, like, makes sense, because the Buddha's not going to use his psychic powers to know the minds of others all the time, so he needs to be persuaded, it seems, in the sense that the person persuading is putting his attention on the situation. So.
Mm-hmm. Onto the thing,
yeah. It doesn't seem like it's a something mysterious that he has to be persuaded.
Yeah.
It's like someone putting his attention on something so that he can get a better view of what's going on, and then he makes
the decision. Sure. Part of that depends on what kind of omniscience people think that the Buddha had, because the kind of omniscience which the Jain teacher Mahavira claimed to have was continuously knowing everything all the time.
All at once.
All at once. Which would kind of freak you out a bit, wouldn't it?
And does it take away the motivation for others to in any way question anything that they're unfair?
Yeah.
So isn't that, in a way, allowing people to plead the case is empowering, and also giving that person that growth to really practice karma?
That's a very good point, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
And that also comes across where you find that kind of explanation given in the context of the Jains, and also in the context of some later Buddhist things where the disciples are coming forward with the kinds of questions, and then he's, you know, for example, the parody of it is, you know, why did you go into the village and the dog bit you? Oh, well, the dog had to bite me, it was destiny, you know, I knew it was going to bite me, but it had to bite me anyway, and these kinds of explanations. And so you can never... You can never actually learn anything from that. It's just always this kind of self-defeating process. Yeah, so that's quite a good point. Yeah.
why I think it might be mood is because the seedling simile is just a seedling, but the Brahma's simile of the calf and the cow brings in a beguiling thing, you know?
It's more emotional.
There's a word for when you
tugging the heartstrings.
We
understand.
Manipulate.
Not manipulate. Sway.
Well,
okay.
Manipulate, that's the one.
Blah blah blah. According to the explanation given in the Melinda Pandahau, however, even when these two similes were delivered for the first time, they were nothing new to the Buddha, since with him, his omniscience, he anyway knew about them. This attempt to harmonize events with the belief in the Buddha's omniscience is not convincing, since on reading the account given in the Chatamaya Sutta and its Chinese parallel, there seems to be little reason to doubt that these two similes did indeed soften the Buddha's attitude.
Then I went on and talking about omniscience. Yeah. So it's good if you could clear up what omniscience actually is.
Yeah. Omniscience.
In the Buddhist context.
I don't know.
The Dalai Lama, he was specific about it. At some point he did say that omniscience is when on whatever problem or whatever there arises, if the Buddha puts his mind to it, at that point it's omniscience. It's not that he constantly
knows everything. Right.
So a particular point he puts his mind on it, and that point is totally
clear.
Omniscience. That was his explanation, and I would somewhat go along with that.
That's quite reasonable.
Yeah.
Right.
He said the low sees it that way, and the high sees it more. That's what I'm saying.
Well, he's probably right. Yeah.
And can I go back a little bit? And I find it interesting that the Buddha actually did not say anything to his chief disciple, please restrain
your students.
Yes,
yeah.
But actually took direct action. I think there's an interesting point there.
Yeah, well, we're just about to go into the bit where they was talking to Sariputra Moggallana, so we'll see if there's any. But yeah, certainly that's an interesting kind of thing there. So, according to the commentary and the individual translation, Mahamoggallana learnt about this with his use of the divine eye, or his psychic powers. Well, according to the Ekotara Agama report, the Buddha had just looked at Ananda, who understood what this implied, and in turn informed Sariputta that the monks were allowed to return. So, make that as you wish. Maybe he just heard about it.
Seems really silly that commentary can just explain everything as this very discreet, you know, threads of everybody doing discrete things and speaking each other's thoughts out and just very analytical way of seeing things unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, it's quite normal to think something and then forget about it, and then someone reminds you and it changes your mind, and then somebody else has the same thought because they're working on something with the same, and then you just kind of hook up because you're doing the same thing, and it's just really normal.
Yeah.
But the Buddha is not normal.
Well, he sort of is.
Kind of like an nth degree normal.
Yeah, but I think he's not referred to as normal.
Like, you know, maybe
he's
like
super normal. More normal than normal. Okay. Then Blessed One asked the Venerable Sariputta. So maybe we'll learn about that question about why did he go directly to the monks and not through their teachers. He asked Venerable Sariputta, "What did you think, Sariputta, when the Sangha of Bhikkhus was dismissed by me?" Okay. Then, Venerable Sir, I thought thus. The Tango of Bhikkhus has been dismissed by the Blessed One. The Blessed One will now abide inactive, devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. Now the Venerable Sariputta and I... Oops, no, sorry, no, it makes... Sangha of Bhikkhus has been dismissed by the Blessed One. The Blessed One will now abide inactive, devoting to a pleasant abiding here and now, and we too shall now abide inactive, devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. Okay? Aposukko, inactive. Aposukko, without too many hassles. Dani, now the Blessed One, Ditta Dhamma Sukha Viharang. Ditta means visible. Dhamma means Dhamma. Sukha means happiness. Viharang, abiding. Basically, that means going into jhanas and other kind of fun places. Anuyuto, attached. Devoted to, perhaps better, viharisati, will develop, and mayampi, we too, will dwell with no hassles and devoted to enjoying ourselves as much as possible right now. Okay, so this thing, Ditta Dhamma, is often translated as here and now or something like that, so sometimes it means in this very life. Sometimes it means, right, what we're going to do now. And the Buddha replies, Agamehi Tvang Sariputta, Agamehi Tvang Sariputta. So he doesn't say, Mahevang Avacha, don't say that. He says, Agamehi, wait, Sariputta, wait, Sariputta.
Literally, it means don't go there, is it?
It's from Agama, so coming, yeah, and it is the root gachati, but it's the prefix is the A, not a negative, yeah. So it's Agamehi, but as an idiom, it literally means to wait, yeah. Wait, well stop. Such a thought should not be entertained by you again. Na kote Sariputta. Punapi, not again. Eva rupang, such a kind of chitta upadapetabam. Okay, don't give rise to that kind of mind again.
It's
used in every kind of way. Okay. Sukha is used in every kind of way, and you have to look at it, you have to understand it in the context.
So sukha is a general word.
Sukha is very, very general. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Can we have some light? I can't read when I'm reading. Thanks.
Asanipatutan Sukha in reference to the Buddha have a different connotation because the Buddha would access states which are accessible to the Buddha. And like Venerable Sariputta somehow implied you and me are doing the same.
I wouldn't think so, no. Yeah, no, he's just saying, you know, basically we're going to sit here in samadhi. Yeah, that's really all he's saying. So, but interesting that he says no. So there you go. Then he addressed Venerable Moggallana and said, Moggallana, what did you think when I dismissed all those monks? And Moggallana says, Venerable Sir, I thought this. The Sangha of Bhikkhus has been dismissed by the Blessed One. The Blessed One will now abide inactive, devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. Now the Venerable Sariputta and I shall look after the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Okay? Shadani ayasmacha Sariputto Bhikkhu Sanghang pariharisamati. Okay, so we will pariharisama. Look after, lead. We had Pamukha as leading before. Take care of, something like that. And the Buddha's response, Sadhu, Sadhu Moggallana. Yeah? I shall look after the Sangha of Bhikkhus, or Sariputra and Moggallana should. Yeah. So does this contradict the passage in the Vinaya where the Buddha says to Devadatta, I wouldn't even let Sariputra and Moggallana leave this Sangha, much less a blob of spit like you?
It's talking about the whole Sangha, not the five years, 5 years. Different.
Sorry?
It's different. He's talking about this 500 monks, not the entire Sangha.
Yeah.
Specific case.
There's 500 bhikkhus. Oh, Sangha of bhikkhus.
Yeah.
That's the Sangha of bhikkhus.
This.
Yeah, maybe. Is it the same word that's used? I'm not sure. But anyway, it seems to be a different context. Here is obviously just saying, you know, for the time being, you guys look after it, rather than saying someone's going to be appointed as the leader for all time. Okay. Where are we?
It's funny, because...
Yeah?
Nam says, good, Raghunatha, either I shall lead the Sangha of bhikkhus, or else Sariputra Moggallana shall lead it. So it's not Markaspa, the father of the Sangha anymore.
Mm.
It's constantly referring
to the leading of the Sangha, yeah. Obviously, they died by the time of the. Just before we go on to see if anything with that, the Chatama Sutra and the Chinese parallels agree on reporting that once Sariputra and Moggallana had returned, the Buddha asked them what they thought. And he dismissed the monks. And according to the Pali and Ekotra Agama account, both had thought that the Buddha was now going to live in seclusion, but while Sariputra's intention had been to do the same, Mahamoggallana had been aware of the need to look after the other monks. The individual translation, however, seems to reverse the role of the two monks. The Satchatama Sutta and the Ekotra Agama parallel agree on the Buddha censuring Sariputta and praising Mahamoggallana's attitude. So this kind of relates. There's another little saying somewhere else. Maybe is it the Satchavibhanga Sutta, where the Buddha talks about the Sariputta leading. Let me see if it's here. Blah blah blah. No, that's one. Oh yeah, here we go. Cultivate the friendship of Sariputra and Moggallana bhikkhus. Associate with Sariputra and Moggallana. They are wise and helpful to their companions in the holy life. Sariputta is like a mother. Moggallana is like a nurse. Sariputta trains others for the fruit of stream entry. Moggallana for the supreme goal. Sariputta bhikkhus is able to announce, teach, describe, establish, reveal, expound, and exhibit the Four Noble Truths. So this perhaps also indicating a slight difference between them, that if Moggallana was more sort of continual in his training, kept on looking after them on and on and on, whereas Sariputta thought that it was enough to sort of give them the initial training and then let them find out their way for themselves. So maybe that's a slight difference in their character.
As an Arhata, understand it as the Buddha's fine way of telling the disciples to be more firm with
students.
You know, sort of coming in from that way rather, so that the chief disciples would see the Buddha taking actual action, so they could actually, and step by step, he's making them reflect on.
And that's probably also one of the reasons why he was so quick to dismiss them, perhaps, because he knew that Sariputra and Moggallana would be with them,
In terms of their character, maybe Sariputta wasn't that he was unaware of the Bhikkhu's needs, but that he wouldn't presume to take the place of the Buddha in that way, whereas Moggallana wasn't known for that sort of humility.
I don't know. I don't know if they would be really taking the Buddha's place. I mean, they were already said to be leading the group of monks.
But it was a big sign.
Because Sangha as a whole, it's always a bit funny. It's always a bit ambiguous with these things. You never quite know. It just says the Sangha, and it's always a bit uncertain to what extent it means the whole Sangha or just this group of monks happen to be here.
So the number sort of determine it a bit, because usually 500, 5,000, or 50,000can get used. So just 500, just suggested.
In the Pali Suttas, it's usually either 500 or the bigger group is 1,250.
Oh, is that how long?
Yeah.
Oh.
The other multiplications of it, maybe in Mahayana sutras, you find them. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, even in that case, even when you have 1,250 bhikkhus, it just means
a lot.
Yeah. So say in the Samanyapala Sutta, the Buddha's speaking, there's 1,250 bhikkhus in Rajagaha. I mean, it probably means the monks from Rajagaha who were all there pretty much, you know. But it doesn't necessarily imply that all the monks everywhere were there.
I would also understand because the teachings of both chief disciples are somewhat different in their aim, that when their disciples meet, they just check with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought about the whole commotion of being noisy.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think that they would just sort of talk, gossip and others. They talk. Maybe they were exchanging
friendly. Saying hello.
In the monastic life, like when the monks train, how is the number of bhikkhus to a teacher, how does it vary in like how many monastics live in a group? So in this case, because I remember that there's, let's say, in one case there's like six that they live together, and in this case there's a whole bunch. So I guess it's just out of curiosity.
Yeah,
it
could vary a lot.
How many students does a teacher have?
Could vary a lot.
Vary from like a few to 200?
Yeah.
It's basically, it comes down to how many you can look after, and Sariputta is used as the ideal model in the case in the vinaya. So being the ideal model, I guess having lots of students for him is okay.
Yeah.
Actually, isn't it the bhikkhuni rule, or the bhikkhuni that an established bhikkhuni can only ever have one student every so many years? There was a definite set of
I can't remember.
Every 1 year, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Every year you can only ordain one student. Mm-hmm. Or each.
Something like that, yeah.
That's so done, not to be so. I don't know if it affects if a student came from another teacher. Because that's in the section of giving the going
class. Yeah.
Either the Buddha or someone like to remind Sariputta and Moggallana that if she is not around, that they have to also continue to guide the bhikkhus. Because how Sariputta responded to him was that he would also go into his present life.
It says something about taking turns, doesn't it? So like when we're having retreats, you take turns. Someone goes on retreat and the other people look after them. Yeah. Not everyone does it at the same time. Yeah.
The whole thing is quite pleasant. There's no...
Yeah, very, it's very gentle. Yeah. Very friendly. Yeah. Okay, now then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. There are these four kinds of fears or dangers to be expected by those who go down into the water. Udakorohante. What for? They are the fear of waves, fear of crocodiles, fear of whirlpools, and fear of sharks. These are the four kinds of fears to be expected by those who go down into the water. Here, so too, because there are four kinds of fears. So, fearful fears is the, where are we? Fear of umi is the waves. Kumbhila is the crocodiles. Crocodiles? Kumbhila? Fear of whirlpools, avata. Whirling around, and susuka is the sharks.
How do we know about sharks in the middle of?
And also crocodiles. I'm not sure whether they are native animals to India.
Crocodiles?
Yes.
Yeah.
Are they?
Yeah,
I'm sure you'd have crocodiles around.
Yeah,
just crocodiles, certain species of the present.
There you go.
I probably had sharks in
the
Yeah.
Like fish water, the ones who come in.
Yeah, some come up quite.
But probably, but also the waves, the fear of waves would seem to be an ocean thing, wouldn't it? You don't have to be afraid of waves on the Ganges River, so probably talking about an ocean. It is interesting, because the Buddha uses the ocean as a simile quite a lot, but he never went there. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Maybe he saw it on YouTube or something.
Children's stories, the shark come
Yeah, look, I'm sure there's plenty of stories around. Okay. What is fear of waves? Here, some clansman goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering, I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely, an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. This is a chant which is chanted in the Thai morning chanting or evening chanting. O tien nom hi jatiya jaraya maranena sokehi paridevehi dukehi domana sehi upaya sehi. Dukho tien no dukha pareto apevanami masa kevalasa dukha kandasa antikiriya panyaye arati. So that's very nice. After he's gone forth thus, his companions in the holy life advise and instruct him thus. You should move to and fro thus, you should look ahead and look away thus, you should flex and extend your limbs thus, you should wear your patched cloak, bowl and robes thus. Okay? So he's gone forth out of faith to seek the end of suffering, and the monks is telling him what to do all the time.
Don't do this, do that.
And notice that the words that's used, the phrases used, the same phrases as in the famous passage on clear comprehension, going and forth and returning, one acts with clear comprehension, looking to the front and to the side, one acts with clear comprehension, bending and extending the limbs, one acts with clear comprehension, and carrying the bowl and sangati and the robes, acts with clear comprehension. So here it's not the awareness aspect of it is not being mentioned, but here the proper conduct is. So this is basically the instructions on how to go for alms route, is what's actually going on here. When you go for alms and you're told to sort of walk in a restrained manner and so on and so forth, not be jumping all over the place, skipping over puddles like a monkey, like Sariputta used to do. Okay? Now, and he thinks, formerly, when I was an Agarya Buddha, in the household life, we advised and instructed others. And now, these bhikkhus, who seem like they might be our sons or our grandsons, think that they can advise or instruct us. And so he forsakes the training and reverts to the low life. He is called one who has forsaken the training and reverted to the low life because he was frightened by the fear of waves. Now, fear of waves is a designation for anger and irritation, called upayasa. Angry despair is probably better. Yeah.
Is it the origin? Hinayana? Hinayawato?
Yeah, Hinayawato.
So the lesser.
Yeah. So, does that have any? Of course, that wouldn't have any relevance for anybody here, would it?
Well, no, but it might. Yeah, if you're constantly told to do something, if you maybe wear the same clothes all the time, and you know, all those things might lead to angry despair eventually.
Yeah. Penny Joker is a good example of someone who got over that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He used to take out the compost every day.
Yeah. Okay.
We did have a case, I won't mention the monk's name, but he was from a high caste in Nepal.
Uh-huh.
And when he came, he was like a patriarch of the family and had grown up kids and had been used to being the boss. And then and he ordained, and all these young monks, half his age, were above him, and he found it very painful to take orders.
Yeah.
And he ended up disrobing as well.
Was there a character called Tuchiputila?
Tuchiputila.
Tuchiputila, yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure where that's. The story Dajin Chah talks about, I'm not sure where it comes from, actually.
It's from the Dhammapada.
Is it?
Stories.
Dhammapada stories.
If it's a story and display something, then it's probably from Dhammapada.
And Amatanandi. I don't think so, no. He's born as a monkey for 500 past lives. So.
According to the.
According to something?
So, Bhante, the arahats, when they see their habits, they persist.
They can. They don't stop drinking coffee.
And they're hanging around. They're jumping around here.
Yeah, going, you know, like...
skipping? Okay.
Surfing.
Surfing.
Crowd surfing or something. Tay.
The enlightened surfer?
Tay, the enlightened surfer, yeah. Never had any thoughts or emotions and didn't have to eat.
Surf.
Yeah. Just sat out in the waves and was enlightened.
Didn't have any fear of waves,
then? No, obviously not. Oh, sharks. What bhikkhus is fear of crocodiles? Now, here, a clansman goes forth out of faith, thinking, surely an end of this old mass of suffering will be discerned. After he's gone forth, his companions in the holy life advise and instruct him thus, this can be eaten by you. Okay. Kharitabhang. And this you cannot eat. This you can consume. Bunjitabhang. And this one you can't eat. Bunjitabhang. This one you can. Saitabhang. Translated as tasted by you. And this one can be drunk by you. Patabhang. So these ones are the eating. Kharita and Bunjitabhang and Saitabhang. Really pretty much the same meaning. Just meaning to eat something. And then Patabhang is from the root. To drink. This is you can consume what's allowable, what is kapya, okay? And you cannot eat what is not allowable, akapyang. And so on and so forth. You can eat at the right time, in the time, and you cannot eat in the wrong time.
Cannot drink what is not allowable.
And so on and so forth. Proper time. Many things.
Formerly.
When I was a...
Pull bear at the top. Pull bear. Agari. Four times from the top.
Okay. Pull bear. Agari. Buddha. Okay. Formerly when we lived in the household, we consumed what we liked and did not consume what we did not like. We ate what we liked and did not eat what we did not like. We tasted what we liked and did not taste what we not like. And so on and so forth. We ate what we like when we like, as this was Morris Walsh's reason for disrobing. He couldn't get to eat what he wanted when he wanted. Now, when faithful householders give us good food of various kinds during the day outside the proper time, it seems these bhikkhus put a muzzle on our mouths. Okay. Diva vikale panitang karniyang bhojaniyang denti. They give us nice food. Tatapi mukha varanang manye. An obstruction for the mouth. Karanti. Okay. And then he, because of that, he disrobes. So, also quite the relationship between this and the crocodile being fairly self-explanatory.
Where's fright come into it?
You're
a greedy person and he can't do what he likes with food.
It's a similar, because when you go into the water, there's this few things that you can become fearful of, or that are to be feared.
Fearful of the restrictions.
Think of it like a danger, as well as a fear, like a danger.
Using that similarity, threat. Using those four different things.
They don't put the muzzle on the crocodile.
They're probably buying them. Yeah.
A tie, isn't it? Chops up.
That's quite true, actually. It wouldn't be afraid of going down into the water if the crocodiles had their muzzles tied up.
It's not very good simile.
Well, it's a good simile, but it's not quite used 100%.
Yeah. I think it's like when Pasi said, it's not that he's disrobing out of this fear, it's that danger of the crocodile, which is himself.
Right. Yeah. And yes, exactly. And the crocodile, as you're saying, is this is all kind of projection, isn't it? Yeah. There's no actually no way into no crocodiles. It's just all your ideas about it. Yeah?
So can this video we chanted last week? By Dasali. I've seen danger in the times before.
Right.
So it's a wholesome kind of vision of danger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to do that, don't you? It's what you learn when you're a kid, you know. You know, and don't put your tongue in the electricity socket and things like that. you don't do it again.
So the four dangers here. One of them, the troubled water that represents anger and despair. And did we do the
We're at the crocodile.
Yeah.
And the crocodile represents what?
Not eating what you want.
Eating what you want. The fear.
Was it greed?
Greed. Fear of gluttony. There's a designation for gluttony. We didn't get that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now we've got whirlpool.
So that's representing
kind of
like the
weaknesses.
Yeah.
Okay, and what bhikkhus is fear of whirlpools? Here some clansman goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness. He thinks, I'm a victim of birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an end of this whole mess of suffering can be known. Then after he's gone forth, and when it is morning, he dresses, taking his bowl and outer robe. He goes into the village or towns for alms, with his body unguarded, with his speech unguarded, with mindfulness unestablished, and with sense faculties unrestrained. Okay. So, arakitena kayena, arakitena vachaya, anupatitaya satya, asanguttehi indriyehi. He sees some householder there, or some householder's son, furnished and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, enjoying himself with them. With the five cords of sensual pleasure, yes. He considers us. Formerly, when we were in the home life, we were furnished and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, and we enjoyed ourselves with them. This family has wealth. I can both enjoy wealth and make merit. So, saka I can, bhoge, jabunjitum, enjoy wealth, and punya, literally almost like to eat wealth. And punyani chakatun, so I can do merit. And so he forsakes the training and reverts to the low life. And thus he was frightened by the fear of whirlpools. Now, fear of whirlpools is a designation for the five aspects or qualities of sensual pleasures. Which is quite a nice simile, isn't it? Because that's what you do, you get caught in those things, you get rolled around and round and round, and you never get anywhere.
So that's
a lot of fun.
No,
that expression that the monk's using, the idea of the five cords of sensual pleasures, that seems like an idiom that it's not just a monastic thing talking about the five cords.
Oh, not at all, yeah.
Just the way they refer to it, so it's actually a common expression.
I think so, yeah.
They're talking about the five cords of sensual pleasures.
Yeah. And normally would, of course, be used in a positive sense. Mm. Normally, yeah?
Mm.
Yeah? It'd be, you know, the nice things, you know, having nice things and enjoying yourself, yeah.
Just interesting the way they express it.
Yeah.
Putting them into a group.
Yeah. And what bhikkhus is fear of sharks?
This is not
here, okay, anyone who doesn't like naughty bits, please leave the room. Are you all over 18? Sign a piece of paper saying that you're 18 years of age, please. Here, some clansman goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering, I am a victim of birth, aging, and death. Surely an end of this whole mess of suffering can be known. Then, after he's gone forth thus, when it's morning, he dresses, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he goes into the village or town for alms, with his body unguarded and mindfulness unestablished and sense faculties unrestrained. He sees a woman there, lightly clothed, lightly dressed. When he sees such a woman, lust infects his mind. Because his mind has been infected by lust, he forsakes the training and reverts to the low life. He's called one who has forsaken the training and reverted to the low life because he was frightened by the fear of sharks. Now, fear of sharks is a designation for women.
There's lots of games, and in some way it's like,
How come that's a different one than the, doesn't that belong in the category of the five sense pleasure? Because it's like just a sight and just like mind stuff.
Yeah, it is, but then the other ones are as well also, aren't they? Like, you know, eating what you like and stuff like that is also a sensual pleasure. But I think the point with that thing, that's like an idiom when you see the householder's son enjoying himself with sense pleasure. Basically, that just means that he's got a nice house and luxurious things and nice clothes and he's eating and it's just that whole kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what it's talking about. But, you know, yes, of course, everything else is included within that as well.
So there's really just the Buddha's talking about just two of the hindrances in this case, like ill will, anger, they're trying to avoid, and then desire. Is that understanding?
Yeah. Mm. Pretty much, yeah. Mm.
Then there's like three categories here for desire.
Yeah.
It's like pride, gluttony, and joy. Sloth.
Seven deadly sins.
And lust.
So So he notices that it kind of is interesting.
You should have that to your book, don't you? Head Sharks, the title.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there anything in folk tales and stuff likening sharks with women?
You mean, is there anything?
Is
this is like the one of the fundamental images.
Fundamental.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The image of the woman as the sea monster is one of the basic mythic imagery. The siren is like an evolved form. No, the siren's an evolved form, but the more primitive form is like the leviathan or some kind of sea monster and so on. Tiamat in Mesopotamia. No.
Not female.
No, they're usually personified as female. The sea monsters.
Leviathan's
not female.
Joy.
Definitely
male shark.
Just to bring it up to date, sort of current moment.
Yeah.
Sorta,
yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
They're an endangered species.
Many of
them?
The female one.
It's
always
a
difficult
area.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, no, but classically the subterranean monster of the ocean is classically seen as being a woman who's vanquished by the male hero. This is like the
I'm thinking of St. George and the Dragon, that's all male.
That's a later version of it, yeah, but the kind of classical versions is like what's his name? Baal vanquishing Tiamat in the kind of the Mesopotamian myths, and the same in. Sorry?
Baal is also a male?
Yes, and that's why he vanquishes the female monster, Tiamat. Yeah. Trust me on this, alright? It's the classical motif, alright? There are hundreds of examples of where the male sword wielding hero. Kills the Leviathan of the deep, who's personified as
a woman.
It is.
The Leviathan is not a female.
Absolutely.
And no way.
Absolutely.
In nowhere is it.
Not in the tarot cards, no.
It's not in the in a lot of European countries you also have tales like that where you get a female siren telling about the water and
sirens, yeah, they lure the they lure
the sirens are
also
sea so long.
It's not a sea monster, you're not a shark.
What do the parallel texts say about this? Are you identical?
Yeah,
it's going
to
be the same.
Probably the same. Yeah, Anaya doesn't discuss it much.
What about the second set in the Anguttara Nikaya from the first sutta?
Uh-huh.
You know the first sutta, the Anguttara.
Yeah.
It has it in the opposite straight afterwards.
Yeah.
So it's just the context. It's just the context in which it's used. If it's addressed to monks, then it's in feminine form. But if it's addressed to nuns, then it's in the opposite
form.
So in the Anguttara Nikaya, when it talks about the greatest danger for a woman is the man.
And then the shark too.
It doesn't say shark as such, but the way I forgot what's the words that they use in that. Do you remember?
There's no other form.
There's no other form.
Yeah.
As enticing
and
as
attractive.
Well, you know, Tenzin Palma. She actually instructed her teacher that it was actually his problem that he was having impure thoughts.
Right.
But she said, "My mind is pure." And she was trying to, because they hadn't taught a female before. He was saying that, you know, you're creating, you know, you, and she just said it's your problem.
Yeah. And
so she then vowed to take incarnation as a female forevermore. Because this is the stumbling block.
And it's very clear from here that it's obviously is the monk's problem as well. I mean, it says it's lust invades his mind, and it's the lust which is a problem, and it's by that that he disrobes. So the psychology of it is very straightforward and very clear, and that's not an issue. The issue is the imagery with which it's presented, which is the stumbling block.
It's uncomfortable, I think, if you're a female.
Of course, yeah.
Because, you know,
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's a quiet word.
Really? No,
but if you put the monks in the same reverse, as addressed to a nun, the male deer thought of as a shark as well. For the
Yes, that makes more sense.
The
monks are sharks.
Men.
Men.
We're in a real estate agency.
It comes out of how you feel about sort of discovering the Dharma and wanting to practice Dharma, and then there are parts of the teachings that are like a shark if you're a female, particularly, because it's like suddenly a chunk gets taken out of you, bitten out of you, because you're incarnated as a female in this lifetime. It's the one area that I do find uncomfortable with the teaching. And I wonder how much of it is actually cultural. How much it's to do with the culture of the time and the geography of the time, etc. And, you know, is there some way that the Dharma can actually sort of, address it nowadays, because it's discriminatory.
Disregarded,
Dan. Well, it's discriminatory in a way, isn't it?
No,
it's actually quite offensive, because I don't know about everyone here, but I know for me, this is my path of purification, and so that when a teaching comes, that in a way infers, because of your gender, that you have a problem.
That you're only a problem to the other gender, and they're a problem to you.
Well, I mean, for me, it's always about me working through my feeling about it, my response to it, and fortunately, I mean, I'm in a much more softer place than I used to be with that. So in that sense, I'm making some sort of progress about how I feel when the teaching actually takes this direction.
I think it might come into culture, because in the I don't know, because I'm from Thailand, so for to listen to this type of teaching, maybe on the, not on the contrary, but I feel maybe Buddha was kind in that he was trying to protect both parties, because in the reality, the lust can happen to the either female lay person or the monk's mind. So it's just to be kind to both parties. That's how I feel, and especially in Thailand because we are very kind of very distant from the monk, so we don't feel much about this. But I understand in the West, yes, certainly you feel that.
Thank you.
I also see there's the shark symbolizes a situation which is very hard to escape. So I also see the parallel of a situation when lust arises. It's very hard for new people, so for new bhikkhus or for new monastics, it's very hard to escape. So it's like to show the danger, like it, when you when you're pursued by a shark, it's very hard to. Bring home the aspects of danger.
And the shark is the thought. The thought that you have, or whatever, the what's happening in the mind, you can't, it's like you can't escape, kind of. It's kind of like you're being devoured.
So it's like a symbol. It's a symbol.
Of course, yeah. And in all of those cases, then the. It's been similar in all the cases, the kind of the crocodiles and things, it's not actually anything bad, it's just what you're having to do to restrain your mouth, that's all. So there's no actual kind of literal problem with the text as such. It's just the associations of the imagery which is quite problematic, So this is one of the things. But I'll just add here just as a technical note, but the word that's used for women here is matugama. And this word, in Pali, it's kind of interesting. They have two words for a woman. One is matugama, the other one is iti. And iti is always used together with the word purisa, as in man and woman, whereas matugama is always used in... So if you're talking just an ordinary case, you're saying that there was a man and a woman and they went down to the shops or something like that, then you use iti and purisa. But in this kind of case, especially where it's talking about monks and the relationship with women and the need to be restrained and these kinds of things, then it always uses this other word, matugama. And it seems to me, and it's not entirely sure, but in any case, Helmut Hecker is a great German scholar. He had the theory that they actually have quite a distinct connotation to the words iti and matugama. And that may well be the case. So certainly, for example, in the Vinaya, in the Parimokkha, when you read the word purisa, it's always purisa and iti, and when it's matugama, it's always matugama and bhikkhu. And so the idea is that matugama is like a word which is used when it doesn't mean all women. It's when you're using it in a negative context is the word you use. So it's not as condemnatory as it sounds. So that could be an idiomatic thing, but it's difficult difficult to.
That actually makes quite a distinction, doesn't it, in a way?
Yeah.
No, I quite like that, thank you, because it's sort of.
Apparently Hecker could see that. He could see a parallel with a particular German usage, which is not the same in English. So I'm not. Not sure about that. Has anyone heard of that? Yeah, do you have different words for talking about women? It was something like I can't remember. It was an idiomatic way of talking about women in German.
Yes, there were actually, and it comes from the translation of the Bible, which then some people were offended, where it was, woman was called wife, which was sort of a more derogative way of addressing, and now, in all the places, they're chanting as Frau, as Mrs. kind of thing.
Okay.
So that has been going on for some time, but Matu somehow brings back somehow some kind of relation to mother.
Yeah. So this is, Matu is the same root as mother, So almost literally mother kind is what it means.
Yes. So perhaps something to do with the mature woman or something like that, I do not know. We can go on forever on that.
But it's just, this is, anyway, there's not too much, I don't know how much more. Well, I don't know, my book is approaching 400 pages now, so you can read
it.
To recap,
the second one, so the first one was anger, and that's represented the mind being disturbed, is that it? And the second one was pride? And what was the representation of that?
No, no, no. The first one was anger.
Whirlpool was centered there, right? And that was a whirlpool.
Fear of waves, fear of crocodiles, fear of whirlpools, and fear of sharks.
Okay. And when the Buddha talks about, because I know that nowadays when people talk about water, it represents just the state of the mind. Is it safe to? I guess I'm just projecting. When Buddha's talking about water, he's talking about the state of the mind, right?
Yeah.
So what would the alligator do?
Greed.
And then the whirlpool was
sensual
desires,
sensual
pleasures. Okay. Like, I don't have a book.
Do you know what the fourth one is?
See how cyclic it is.
So, Bhante,
the most notorious thing about sharks is that they eat everything, even their own selves.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that relate with a woman? A woman is the caring, the giving, like that. That's the look around the children.
The men are thinking about a woman.
Ah,
he's the shark.
It's the projection.
The chunk.
Yes.
I also see a connection to the vibrational state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
With the four symbols.
Uh-huh, which is?
Well, fear of waves, you know, anger, you're oscillating.
Uh-huh.
And fear of sharks, there's again a movement there, and then there's the crocodile is rushing about.
Uh-huh.
The whirlpool again, like you feel something sucked in, sucked into a particular situation, a particular even emotion.
Yeah.
So you could perhaps also go in that one. Also.
Yeah, and also with the whirlpool, when you start out, it's kind of quite gentle.
That's right.
Yeah, you don't kind of realize that. Well, this is fun.
The question is then how to deal with these strong emotions when you are sucked in a whirlpool or you are being eaten by a shark. It is very difficult to get out of.
It is, yeah. Excuse me, good shark, do you think you might stop eating me?
Yeah. Well, you just have to zip back into the rose.
Too quick to move. The rose don't protect.
Yeah,
go to a different city.
I think it's part of our conceptual level of sharks at the present moment. Sharks don't eat very many people, actually. People eat a lot more sharks than
that's
sharks
true
eat
people.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
They might bite, but they don't eat.
Well, they swallow.
No, very rarely. They very rarely do anything to people but bite.
You know the theme tune that goes with Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if we were aware in our minds that there's a potential shark situation coming along, wouldn't it be nice if there's boom, 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 boom?
You could set that up.
But you know, putting it on in there.
That's quite a good idea, actually. Yeah, it could be your mindfulness training, isn't it? Yeah, and you come and you get this training, doom.
Stop paddling.
I have a last speculation. It's interesting that symbols of to do with water or water elements are being used throughout rather than, for example, lion, you know, something to do with earth or something to do with birth. So.
Yeah, I think the water here is a symbol for samsara, yeah? The ocean of samsara. And again, I mean, that's a very, you know, because it started out saying fear of birth, aging, and death, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very kind of fundamental, like the ocean is often a womb symbol in mythology and so on. So
it all connects, you know.
Yeah.
when you look at it closer, it actually does connect.
Yeah.
Mm. Sensuous eyes often compared to a flood, like ogre. Like
yeah,
being
yeah.
flooded with sensuous eyes,
yeah.
being caught.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's quite potent.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most. It's probably the flood is always kind of the most destructive force in nature, just about. I mean, even an earthquake or a fire or something, some things survive.
Volcano.
But if there's a flood, everything goes, it disappears.
Volcanoes.
Volcanoes pretty bad, yeah.
Flood of lava.
Flood of lava. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was in deeper than that. I think in Park's system,
yeah.
they actually dissect emotions into elements, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Yeah.
So perhaps there's something to do with the water element in that particular situation.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure. Sorry, another Nandi.
What about water in the sense of, because you put on the ropes, if you are undertaking the practice,
yeah.
so it's to swim across.
Yeah.
So isn't it like to undertake the practice, the water is swimming across to Nirvana?
Uh-huh. Yeah, quite using the raft to cross over the, yeah.
So the similarity of the crocodiles and whatnot is the state of mind.
Yeah.
The perceived, whatever is inside.
Could you comment on, I mean, in our society, it's like there's a hunger for just, people seek out emotions, like watching movies, listening to music, and there's that, let's say, pain or being in a whirlpool, but it's a very strong force, because I guess I'm just guessing that craving to be, craving to experience, even though it's painful and suffering. Could you sort of, I don't know, comment on that? Because that's interesting in the sense that people seek out pain, like watch movies that make them cry or to get eaten by sharks.
Yeah, you watch the kind of the Night of the Living Dead and
or just
like that.
Or just like people, you know, you go to movies just to
do bungee jumping
and
stuff.
Music and stuff like
yeah.
that. Do people like pain? Because of that crazy
yeah, well, you need, you it makes you feel alive, yeah?
Yeah.
You can't renounce something until you've done it. I mean, this is the nature of the world. You need to, if you don't actually experience it, how can you actually make it?
You mean I've never been bungee jumping. So does that mean I have to try it before
imagine.
I can get there?
Okay, you've got me on that one. I haven't had.
It. Maybe we need to go.
I know. I don't feel I need someone in another life, but I can do that. thinking more in the more general thing. So
yeah.
to experience something and then
by something which you haven't experienced.
Yeah, and usually you have to do it quite a lot, don't you? To get to that point.
Yes, you have to be about 70 when you reach.
So I guess Buddhist drop. I guess it's good to be aware of this so that when the situation comes, we identify it and see it in the Buddhist framework. So what Buddha says here is that it's new. He points out, no, this is dukkha. It's not happiness, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the training that has to be done, right? Whereas normal society, they seek out stupidity because they think they just follow that force without observing what's going on, right?
Mm.
I don't know. I was just hoping that you can comment that to clarify our view and our framework. So when situations come out, our job is to look at it as no. This is dukkha, right?
Mm.
Remember
something about mistaking pleasure and pain for pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Things that are painful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or the Aryan says. The Buddha Chana says.
Is that finished?
What?
That's it, finished.
Yep.
It's the end of the sentence. Sure.
Could well be the case. Yeah, the whole section, the fourth section at the end, also occurs in the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's very much an Anguttara style sutta. And it's hard to say. I mean, it has a certain thematic consistency in that it's about training for newly ordained bhikkhus. In that sense, there's a kind of thematic consistency. But yeah, there's no particular reason why it would need to be there. It's entirely plausible that the first thing with the event at Chatama was kind of remembered as an episode which sort of said something interesting about training of bhikkhus and the relationship of Sariputra Moggallana with the Buddha and things like that, but that was considered to be of some significance but not substantial enough to make up its own sutta, so it was bunged together with another bit on the training of monks. But that also could happen at the time. I mean, this is the thing, is that there's no reason why the Buddha shouldn't then have, you know, been speaking to those monks and then given a discourse on those kinds of basic training. So it could happen either way.
It does tie in because it said, like, you should take care of the Sangha in the same way. This is what you should do if you're going to take care of the Sangha. Instruct them in this way.
Yeah, yeah.
Setting up.
Yeah.
But it doesn't relate directly to the noisiness of the... It
doesn't mention the noisiness,
no.
Yeah, it's a certain thematic thing, but not directly, yeah.
It's not directly, it's not directly connected,
yeah.
And none of the symbols have to do with noise.
No.
I guess when you're motivated to end dukkha, they're just going to shut up. Bhante, I have a question. Bhante, when you had a text up, I think it was the English commentaries, and I was just looking, and it said that many of the monks became arahants, or something, and then many became streamers because at the end of this discourse. Now, what is this? They don't mention, you know, anatta.
Before we go on, let's just have a look at this. I didn't mention this because it was a bit complicated, but okay. Probably worthwhile mentioning it. Okay. The Chatama Sutta continues with the Buddha delivering an exposition on four types of danger to be expected from a monk gone forth, an exposition recurring in similar terms as the discourses on its own in the Anguttara Nikaya, and that's what we've just been discussing. The Akotara Agama version, however, continues with the Buddha contrasting nine qualities that lead to decline with nine complementary qualities leading to growth, followed by delivering a set of verses on the need to overcome birth, old age and death through right conduct and diligence. Okay, so the Akotara Agama version giving a completely different ending, so that giving quite a strong support for the idea that the ending may have been tacked on, and the felt that, you know, again, it's not necessarily a different Dhamma as such, but obviously a different textual passage. The Akotara Agama discourse concludes by reporting that over 60 monks became arahants while listening to this discourse. The individual translation also reports 60 monks becoming arahants and numerous monks obtaining stream entry at the conclusion of this discourse. It differs from the Akotara Agama version, however, since all that was required according to its account for leading to realization was a single verse spoken by the Buddha. So this pointing to one of the major areas of difference between the different versions of a sutta, and as we've noted many times, is that the actual textual, the actual doctrine and the Dhamma remains constant in the different versions, but the extra material tends to vary quite a lot. So in our Pali version, there's no mention of anyone attaining anything. One of the Chinese versions gives a completely different ending and then says 60 monks attain arahantship, and then another one says 60 monks became arahants and thousands of them became stream enterers. So, or countless of them became stream entry. So this tendency to inflate the effectiveness of the sutta was obviously a strong tendency in the later schools, and we find that countless times through the commentaries, the Dhammapada stories. According to the Dhammapada commentary, each little verse that was recited, then thousands of monks became stream enterers or whatever at the end of it. And similarly, in Mahayana sutras, we find similar tendency. Whereas in the early suttas, the mentioning of people attaining various kinds of things at the end of suttas is fairly rare.
Also, not like access to the nine complementary qualities?
The nine things leading to growth are frequenting good friends, practicing proper conduct, enjoying seclusion, being free from illness, having few possessions, being without attachment in regard to requisites, being energetic, understanding the meaning of what one hears, and being interested to listen to the Dhamma.
What do they mean by being free from illness? I'm not talking about physical illness.
Yeah. Physical illness, yeah. Yeah, it's hard to meditate when you're sick.
Nothing about being quiet, though.
Nothing about being quiet, yeah. In fact, you should frequent good friends. Hey.
Well, maybe that's the enjoying seclusion. Maybe that's the being quiet. Being without attachment in regard to requisites, does that mean you don't care what sort of toothpaste you use?
Yes.
And that's your taste.
Bhante, here, the frequenting good friends. So I remember from another sutta, it all starts by hearing the teachings from Aryans, and the good friends are the Aryans, which provide inspiration and then leads to sense restraint. So is this kind of the same thing? Like once you see good friends, Aryans, you practice proper conduct, which is restraint and mindfulness and all that, and then enjoying seclusion is meditation. And is this the same structure? I don't remember does it sound familiar?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think it's the same as the one that you're referring to. No, there's a stock passage, but I don't think that's it. No. Whether that particular group of nine occurs in Pali, I'm not sure.
Okay.
It may or may not, I can't remember.
Be restrained in your mind, restrained in your speech, and restrained in your body. And she told me to say. I like that. Write it down for her,
aren't
you?
Thanks, yeah.
I'm going round and round my head.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how to do it.
I was
just
right one year that the Buddha was witnessing because, and yet here it says frequenting good friends.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
You could go into that.
Yeah, whether they were good friends or just buddies.
Yes.
Yeah,
so, sometimes thinking too much is also not good because it doesn't really, in that case, you know, not leading anywhere.
The Buddha does explain it in another, doesn't he, what good company is?
The best. It's the best of
all things.
Attributes that come in the meeting.
Seven which are? We know that there's seven of them, that's a start.
What they hear from you, they don't spread around.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. They advise you when you make a mistake.
They're pretty good.
Yeah.
Respected, right.
Stay with you through good and bad times. Yeah. I can't remember.
Desires of your welfare.
Yeah, I think that's in the Sigalavada Sutta. Yeah.
Sigalavada. Sigalakasa.
Dania.
I'm hoping you can correct the understanding of energetic. I understand it as okay, there's a problem, dukkha, And here there is a way to a path and a practice, a training that's possible to overcome this. And is this happiness that arises, that okay, there's something that could be done, is this what is meant by energetic? And if not, could you sort of clarify what is meant here by energetic? This motivation to practice and to
just to do it.
To do it.
Yeah.
Just do it.
Yeah. Drink that coffee. It's pretty sunny.
Yeah, it's interesting to have other people also being mindful. It could be done, they did it.
Okay.
So do you have the nine qualities leading to a decline then?
Oh, it'd be the other opposite to those, yeah.
Just do it, okay.
Sadhu karam tadama se
Sadhu.